This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Hello and Happy New Year from our first Culture Bunker of 2022, your weekend pop culture supplement. I'm Sian Pattenden.
And I'm Andrew Harrison. This week, we are delighted to welcome the blisteringly funny actor and comedian Omid Jalili with us to talk about stand-up in a post-lockdown world and much, much more.
And in the week that the stunningly powerful and really moving Hillsborough drama Anne aired on ITV, we have the rightfully lauded writer Kevin Sampson with us too. How do you handle such a sensitive topic?
And marking what would have been his 75th birthday, we've got Dame David Bowie's new old album, Toy, including two bonus discs of fun, plus what we think of the BBC's The Tourist, starring Jamie Dornan as a man with acute amnesia and a murky past.
All this and more in today's Culture Bunker.
Hello, welcome to the Culture Bunker. Sian, before we start, quick fire round on the big stuff over Christmas. A very British scandal with the Duchess of Argyll. What did you think?
I thought it was horrible rich people doing horrible rich things. What did you think?
I thought I agree, absolutely.
They didn't come off very
they
well,
came off
did
very
they?
Badly. Maybe it turned me into a communist. Don't Look Up, a.k.a. a comet that represents climate change is coming. What did you think?
Meryl Streep, Leonardo DiCaprio, Jennifer Lawrence. I was thinking, well, this is going to be a flop, isn't it? All those star names. I loved it. I've watched it twice now. I made the son watch it as well. I think it's fantastic. And any disaster it could be applicable to, they're going to monetize it. They're going to do awful, you know, political with a big P things. And everyone's going to die. I just thought it was incredible.
Ask me about the Book of Boba Fett. Go on.
What about the Book of Boba Fett,
it's
Andrew?
It's really good. Really liked it. If you're an overgrown man child like me. But yeah. Boba Fett, the character who never says anything, finally gets his own series and gets developed. The bounty hunter, the infamously the most evil and cool person in the Star Wars universe. Turns out he's got sides to him. Turns out he's been on a bit of a journey. I was
this
rather
is a
moved.
Comic, is it?
It's a Disney Plus TV series. So basically,
effectively
a comic, yes.
Oh, I see.
Anyway, so we've cleared that up. Let's get on. New Year's felicitations to the first of our guests today. He posted a picture of himself on Twitter on January the 1st, naked but for an ironing board. Omid Jalili is an actor, an award-winning stand-up comedian, and a self-styled bald avuncular man, his words, not ours. He's appeared in films as far-reaching as Mamma Mia, Gladiator, Sex and the City 2, and Pirates of the Caribbean. He's had his own show on BBC One, co-starred with Whoopi Goldberg in the NBC sitcom Whoopi, and he's just about to embark on the second leg of his stand-up date on his Good Times tour. Hello, Omid. Welcome to the Culture Bunker.
Thank you, Andrew. Great to be here.
First up, what's with the ironing board? What's going on here?
Well, I believe nude lives matter. And it's also a joke about how people who seem to post semi-nude pictures of themselves get a lot of followers. I have since lost 370. I've sent two nude photos of myself up on both platforms, Instagram and Twitter. I've lost a total of 780 followers.
Well, you know, you're weeding out the part-time fans there. Right? This is the right way to do it. You're on. It's half-time on your Good Times tour. It's oranges and cups of tea time before you get in for the exciting next.
Beautifully put. I love that.
Very nice.
Get a bit of a rub down. Get a bit of a chat.
Yeah, don't
manager.
Push it, Andrew.
I'm rinsing it. So what has it been like to getting back to making people laugh in real life on the tour so far? Should we be offering comedy on prescription?
I think it's been fantastic that you see that we've watched stuff digitally, and people need to be out. They need to be, you know, enjoying something in a live setting. Physiologically has a different effect on you, and people absolutely love it. And it's something I can't take for granted anymore. I have to say, it's something that I did take for granted, and for 18 months, I've pined for it, and now that it's happening, it's been absolutely incredible, I have to say.
We're going to talk in more detail about post-lockdown comedy and the next leg of your tour in a bit. But before that, I mean, you're a big fan of music yourself. You recently did a talk about the impact of 80s music and how, in the lyrics of Smooth Operator, Sade Adu was actually singing about you personally. Tell us more about this. How do you know that? How do you intuit this?
In the 80s, I was at a party, and I was I did lots of comedy dancing, and there was a girl who was, I was told she was half Nigerian, and her name was Sade. Oh. And she was a bit older than me. And as well, I think I was about 17 and she was about 23. She kept saying, "This guy's hilarious. He's funny." And she said, "Your moves are very smooth." So when Smooth Operator, I just assumed she was singing about me. I still believe I met her. I remember the face. I met her at a party. I don't think she was thinking about me, but I'm just saying that I've always thought the song was about me for some reason.
You can put on the posters, extremely funny Sade Adu, officially, because you have it from the horse's mouth. Correct me if I'm wrong, you're a big Chelsea fan, but also following Ipswich at the same time. Is this correct?
Yes, I have been a Chelsea fan since I was 5 years old, but I've been living in Suffolk. And actually, I live in Ipswich, and Ipswich Ipswich was everyone's second team in the way Newcastle was everyone's second team in the mid-90s. The Ipswich team of the early 1980s, I can mention all the names of the players. I've even recognised them. Some of them still live in the area, which is amazing. Wow. And I went to the first three games of Ipswich, and they drew 2-2. First game was 2-2, second game 2-2, third game 2-2. So I showed up at the fourth game wearing a 2-2. People started having a go at me, and I realised the Ipswich fans didn't quite see the satirical side of my gag.
You once paid 4,000% markup for Chelsea tickets. Is this true?
God, you've really you've got through my latest Twitter. Yes, it was Chelsea Football Club for the game, the semi-final League Cup game. There was in the programme, they did a little profile piece on me. And actually, it was that story was in the programme where some guests from Iran had showed up at my parents' house, and they said, "We're big football fans. Is there a match?" And my dad said, "There's Stamford Bridge, which is down the road." And it was like, I think it was halfway through the first half. They said, just go with Omid. Omid will translate. And I was six because he likes football. he plays football in the playground with an apple core. This is what you used to kick around an apple core that was playing football. So we showed up, and it was literally, I would say, the second half had started. And we could only get all the box office was closed. Then ticket sales, because your tickets. And we said, "Yeah, how much is it?" They went, "How much you got?" Because that was in those days. I think it was about, if I remember, it was 50 or 60p to get in. And these Iranian guests, they just took out there were pound notes, £5 notes. They goes, "Oh, for the three of you, it's give us this." So we paid £7 each, which was amazingly ridiculous ripoff. And we went in. People were shouting, "What time do you call this, Yasser?" Because the only the only Middle Eastern people they'd seen on television was Yasser Arafat, who was head of the Palestinian Liberation Organization. And these big, heavy-set Iranian men with handlebar moustaches walked in. "What time do you call this, Yasser? Sit down." But then we just thought, that was brilliant. Let's go again. So I went back, and I've never stopped going.
There isn't a continuing football theme to the show, isn't there? Because we have another guest, do we not, Sean?
We certainly do. Kevin Sampson is the author of books such as Away Days and Powder, which were definitely not anything to do with his former job manager of super pop group The Farm. He was once also a writer for The Enemy, but more recently he's become a screenwriter, and he's screenwriter of the powerful and gut-wrenching Hillsborough drama Anne, with Maxine Peake playing the lead role, which has been on this week. Hello, Kevin, and how are you?
I am well, thanks. I'm in rude health. Thank you for having me on.
Wonderful to hear it. Wonderful to hear you. We've just mentioned Anne. We'll talk about it very shortly. But simply, how has the reaction been to the programme?
It has been staggering. I don't think any of us were anticipating or prepared for anything like that. It has been an outpouring of emotion, anger, loads and loads of messages, you know, people that I have not been in touch with for decades have tracked me down. So the response has been phenomenal. As you're probably aware, you know, we have the launch today of Hillsborough Law. So the timing could not have been better either, just in terms of, you know, of giving that a platform.
And we'll be talking about that later. Andrew's going to mention that. What's it like when something you've worked on for so long finally makes its appearance? It must feel surreal having lived it for a while.
Yeah, I think the overriding sensation for me has just been relief, because as you're both aware, you know, this was shot quite a few years ago, and we've had it embargoed, really. It's been on the back burner for 3 years now, waiting for a broadcast slot, while the various trials and processes ran their course. So it was August, end of August, when the last of the trials collapsed. And, you know, I've got to give credit to ITV here, you know, rather than just rush it out, you know, given that I've been waiting for broadcast all that time, they looked for the most powerful and prominent slot that they could give us, which was, you know, the very, very top of the year. Traditionally, I think, you know, people are expecting something a little bit lighter. They're looking to be spoon-fed with their entertainment, really. So it was a brave piece of scheduling, and it's worked for them. It's had a profound effect and reaction.
Hillsborough is always going to be an emotive subject. It seems an understatement for me to say that. But why drama instead of documentary, do you think? Why is drama more powerful in this instance?
I think they're complementary. And with this, we did both. You know, there was a documentary went out last night, a companion piece called The Real Anne. But with drama, you have the ability to really get under somebody's skin and portray the collateral damage, you know, the gradual gnawing agony of grief. And through that, to see, you know, somebody actually, you know, have an emotional response, have, you know, for that anger to actually percolate into action, and see, you know, through the lens of Anne Williams, see the way that all those families and campaigners responded to the grief and injustice that they were placed in, and did something about it. And there's something, you know, admirable about a group of people coming together in these circumstances and taking on the big, you know, it's quite an orthodox story in that respect about you know, the little people rising up against bullies and eventually prevailing against them. And it seems strange to describe, you know, the drama that you've all just sat through as being uplifting, but I truly believe it is, you know, it's inspirational, seeing that the strength of a mother's love to sustain what for her was a 24-year campaign to get to the truth. And for the other families, you know, it's 33 years and running. To actually be able to portray that over four nights and to, you know, allow the nation really to have a glimpse into the, you know, the real heroism of those people. You know, I think it was really, you know, important piece of work.
Absolutely. Before we crack on, though, a tiny reminder. Remember, you can get The Culture Bunker and all our shows early and without adverts when you support The Bunker on Patreon. That means episodes on politics, science, pop culture and much more every day. We're still looking for good new music on The Culture Bunker, so if you can suggest something, you can do it via our Patreon page. We'll see what we can clear and play. Just search Patreon Bunker Podcast to find out more.
Our special guest today is our favourite British-Iranian since Yasmin Laban, and he's better looking too. Omar Jalili's current stand-up tour is called Good Times. We love the optimism. He finished the first leg in London before Christmas. The second starts on January the 14th. He's travelling the length and breadth of the country from Aberdeen to Torquay and beyond. Omar, you were just saying like how good it was to be back with human beings in a room. Are you champing at the bit to get back into it?
Yeah, I mean, the last show I did was at the Hammersmith Apollo, and it was just when the Omicron thing had killed lots of shows. And I think mine was one of the last ones that went ahead. And I know there was a show on before, and Apollo holds 3,600. And we were told that you'll be lucky if you get 800, 900 in. And I couldn't believe 2,500 people came. And I think that the first thing I said is, what a time to be called Omid. And I'm glad I changed my surname to Jalili because it used to be Kron. And it was amazing how everyone laughed. But then when I looked carefully at them, nobody was wearing masks. And I was so overwhelmed by how many people were there. And every time I asked, so is everyone double vaxxed? There was just a kind of, yeah, there wasn't that many people. Nobody was wearing a mask. And I realized afterwards, it must have been inflated. There was an anti-vax march just before.
Oh, God.
I think they all just came to my show. So it was a genuinely amazing experience to do it. And now I was very sad because I thought we're going to have to cancel the rest of the tour. But amazingly, it is still going ahead. During the pandemic, I did do a couple of socially distanced shows where everyone was wearing masks. And it didn't feel right. And I kept saying, this doesn't feel normal, does it? And they were going, no. And I said, look, for normality's sake, why don't we just pretend you're all ISIS hostages? And I'm like the head of a terrorist group who's just got to do a stand-up routine for the Christmas party. And we went for it. And I kept doing jokes and saying, who do I have to shoot to get a laugh around here? And they loved it. It became really, it was normalized. It's like when we were doing Zoom gigs. I kind of didn't like it at first because everybody muted me and I didn't realize. I didn't know there was, in the early days, didn't know there was a chat function. And everybody was saying, that's just me, because I was saying, I'm going to mute you lot if you don't shut up. Because there were people kind of going, could you put the tea on, Jeffrey? You know, in the background. It was really annoying me. And then I said, I can't know how to mute you. And then on the chat, they said, let's just mute him. So 600 people, they muted me, and I could see they were laughing. The way I finished the Zoom gig, which I've finished all my Zoom gigs, which I kind of miss now, is I took the computer to the toilet and I said, and here's the sound of my career. And I flushed the toilet. And I actually miss that now that I can't finish like that. But I have to say, everywhere I've gone, the audiences have been really, they've been up for it. They've been excited. And, you know, I'm beginning to realize why Harry Hill left medicine. Harry Hill was a doctor, and he always says, I found people were healed more through laughter than by pills. Mm. Because when he went round being funny with his patients, he said the ones who responded to humor usually got better. And I'd say, but that, there's an argument there. They were already on their way to getting better. But I just thought that the better use of my time on this planet is to genuinely make people laugh, which is what he's done brilliantly. Mm. But the fact that he used to be, you know, a GP is kind of extraordinary to me. And that's what he chose. So I'm beginning to see that the way people tweet after is, oh my God, I needed that. Actually, my pinned tweet is Eddie Marzan, the actor, who said, I didn't even know I needed to laugh for 2 hours like that. I didn't realize how much I needed it. And you realize when you're with your family, and we all have a laugh, and when you're with other comedians, we laugh all the time, but a lot of people don't. Actually, and you realize that one belly laugh is apparently equivalent to 20 minutes of yoga. Hearing Kevin's, my wife's from the Wirral, and I love hearing Scouse, because they're always so funny. All the Scouse families, because you know, Ahmed's funniness is legendary, and by legendary, I mean it's a myth. They just make fun of me. But actually, a lot of people around the country don't have a laugh. So to see that, how people appreciate it, it's so wonderful.
I'm sure it's a pleasure for you to hear Jalili pronounced in a very, very broad Scouse accent. That's going to be an experience for the ears.
All right, yeah. Almost. That's what they call me, Almost.
Almost. In your material, is it hard to steer away from like doing COVID stuff and, you know, gags about trying to teach the kids long division when you can't remember it yourself and homeschooling? Because the kind of the reservoir of the COVID joke seems to be really kind of a bit dry now, doesn't it? We've all been through such a lot.
I don't know. I mean, look, I realised early on that people don't want certain gags, because I was doing COVID, because you know before we came on, because I'm done with all these COVID variants. Mm-hmm. I was doing jokes with dancing. Like I tell the audience, if you laugh at anything silly, I will dance. And I was doing it. I was dancing when there was no laughter. I was doing jokes like, you know, what's next? The banker's variant, where it's pretty bad, but it clears after 3 working days. Hey, and there'd be no laughter. I'd be dancing. I'd be doing things like, what about, I just had the Alan Titchmarsh variant, which is pretty mild. And when I got better, I was suddenly very attractive to women of a certain age, which I thought were very funny. And then I got the Sean Bean variant, which means whatever part I played, the Russian, Arab or English, I still talked in a Yorkshire accent, which were funny gags, but nobody had the stomach for COVID variant jokes when so many people have been affected by it. Yeah. So I did feel that people wanted to know what your last 18 months have been like, what have you been thinking about. So after I go through all the shared experiences, clapping for the NHS, you know, stuff, how did we feel when Boris was in hospital with COVID, then I talk about the things that I was thinking about, which are very, very specific to me, which is things like white privilege, things like how have people seen me in the, because I was the first kind of Middle Eastern comedian in this country doing stand-up comedy. And then people tell me that I can't do accents right now. And I said, well, hang on, who's they, and who are the comedy police? Isn't it just white, middle-class, middle-aged reviewers? And I said, I'm not having it anymore because I've been the subject of so many microaggressions myself. And even stuff that, for example, the word BAME, B-A-M-E, yeah, which is the politically correct acronym to describe someone like me, coming from the Middle East, where we invented mathematics, refrigeration, and language, I would have thought that we would have got two letters. I thought it was Black, Asian, and Middle Eastern. But it turns out it's Black, Asian, and minority ethnic. Mm. And then when I ask people, what's minority ethnic? And they say, well, that's just everybody else, isn't it? And I said, so I'm like in a Poundland bargain bucket with a billion Chinese and a billion Latinos. We did create running hot water while you lot were painting yourself blue and buggering wild boar. And I have to say, even English people were laughing at that because it is something that when we talk about white privilege, it really is the kind of, it's almost like a virus. It's like the most quiet of all the racism is its stealth. Mm. No one notes. The people who carry white privilege are not even aware of it. And even the people who, you know, are the recipients of it, they feel it, but they don't know where it comes from. Mm. So I talk about the things I've discovered. And by and large, it's gone down extremely well amongst what is, I have to say, I mean, I've got a pretty multicultural audience when it's in London, but out in the, you know, if I travel outside of London, it's a major, I would say 97-98% white English, yeah, British audience that come. And by and large, they've been absolutely fascinated. And see, I don't talk about anything political unless it's funny. I remember talking to Sean Locke about this, that Sean Locke was a very politically minded person, but he said, I would never use the comedy framework to stand on a soapbox. Unless I had a joke, I wouldn't do it. So by and large, everything I've said has been well received because there's always a joke there. I've never really done soapbox comedy. I don't like stand there putting, making a fist and saying this is the way things are. Yeah. So in general, it's people have liked that kind of the lockdown reflections on that, which kind of are representative of what's going on in British society.
Related to what you just talked about there, I want to ask you about your acting roles, because you have mentioned in the past that you often get kind of generic Middle East guy or even like generic not white guy as the role that's offered to you. Is that changing? I mean, we have sort of two contradictory things on the go at the moment, that only people of this ethnicity or identity should play this role versus how about giving non-white people a shot at roles that aren't defined by ethnicity. So they're kind of pulling in two different directions, if you see what I mean. Yes. Have you noticed it changing? Are you getting offered different stuff?
It's a big discussion because it was people like me in the 90s who were complaining, is why is it someone like me? I'm born and raised here. All I can play is terrorist number three. Mm. And then things
They could at
changed.
Least give you terrorist number two.
Yeah, at least, yeah. Well, even in The Mummy, I remember doing The Mummy and I did the audition and the director said, can I give you some notes? And I said, are you kidding me? We've read three pages. I've had two lines. You really want to give me notes? And I said, look, do you know what? Just forget it. I'll do the character for you. Because what you've written in Hollywood is one-dimensional. I can, with a bit of comedy, make this a two-dimensional character. So it was people like me that piped up about it. But then, even then, I'm Iranian, and that character was an Egyptian prison warden. So then I started championing my Arab friends, saying I shouldn't have even played that role because I'm not Egyptian. That should have gone to an Egyptian actor. And then I started playing Jewish roles. Like I played Fagin in Oliver. I played Reb Tevye in Fiddler on the Roof in Chichester. And even then I kept saying, is it right? I'm not Jewish, but you want me to, because yeah, but you're Semitic. So I just assumed I have the Semitic look and I can give it that authenticity. But now I don't think anyone would let me play that role. Even 4 years on, I kind of get that I was probably at the spearhead of all that. And I kind of regret it now because I haven't been offered an Arab role in years. And I kind of miss being an Arab scumbag specialist. But I miss it. But at the same time, I can understand it. Because if there is someone who can play the role better, the general rule should be you should go to the authentic actors first because they should be playing it better. But if you haven't found the right role from that ethnicity, then you can look outside. And I think that's kind of what happened with me with The Mummy. They did look at all the Arab actors first, and then they started bringing out to Iranians and things. So I think that I was just lucky. They'd already seen 63 people for that role before I got it. So if that's the way it works, then I think it's okay.
One thing that of yours that I really enjoyed was The Infidel. written by David Baddiel, where you play a British Muslim. He's not a particularly observant guy. He like listens to rock music and he drinks and stuff, but he has to put on a show being very observant because his daughter is marrying a guy who's got a very devout dad. And then you discover that you're adopted and you're actually Jewish. And you thought you were Mahmoud Nasir and your birth name was Solly Shimshilovitz. It's dead funny. It's incredibly funny. But it's also so near the knuckle. I remember thinking, like, only Baddiel is going to be able to get away with this, and only you are going to be able to get away with playing the role. What was the reaction to that afterwards? I mean, you're actually Baha'i yourself, aren't you? You're neither Muslim nor anything else. Did you get stick from either community?
Interestingly, no, I didn't, because and even Baddiel said, if you look at your character, you are ethnically, I suppose, you're Jewish and you look Jewish, but then you're raised as a Muslim and you look like a Muslim. So it was because David Baddiel himself said he was beaten up twice, I think on the same day, once for being Jewish and once for being Pakistani, because I think some of the he got beaten up by two separate – Baddiel always gets beaten up, and he gets beaten up for many reasons. But he said it was interesting that they thought – and it's interesting. When I first saw David Baddiel, I thought he was Pakistani. I just assumed he wasn't English, but he sounded – I thought, oh, I like this guy. He sounds like me. I'm born and raised here. And that's kind of how we became friends on the comedy circuit. But I think David felt that it was something – because I'm a Baha'i, and David is a staunch atheist, but he said, look, if I ever was going to – listen to any religion. I like the Baha'i faith because the Baha'i faith says that, you know, God is one, religion is basically one, and mankind is one. So he liked the idea of all the religions being different chapters of the same book. And he says, if you look at Jews and Muslims, they're so the Semitic races, we're very similar. Sarah Silverman has a joke because Jews and Muslims both pushy, you know. So he wanted to draw out the similarities of the two cultures, and it was just ridiculous that there is even a Middle Eastern conflict between Arabs and Jews. So in that sense, no, I think a bit like you mentioned, Don't Look Up, where the point of that whole film is that climate change is serious and it's coming. So it actually doesn't matter if people like the film. I mean, I thought it was a very funny film. So in America, I had some friends of mine goes, I kind of wished it to be funnier. And I say, it doesn't matter. They go, oh, I got some terrible reviews. I say, it doesn't matter. The film is so well-intentioned and it's so good. And those of us in the know understand that tonally to get that right is impossible. Mm. So it kind of doesn't matter if people like it or not, it's there. And it's when people say, oh, insulate Britain, there's got to be a better way than stopping traffic. Well, they've done it. They've made something that is different to stopping traffic. This is for the globe. Everyone will see it. And I think it was the same with The Infidel. The actual goal of making that film was to say, mankind is one, religion is one, stop fighting. So it didn't even matter. And the biggest compliment we had was Robert De Niro bought the film for American release. Mm. It was at the Tribeca Film Festival. And I remember him telling me, because this film is absolutely hilarious. I always thought that after 9/11, there'd be some film about Muslims, but I didn't think it would be this funny. And I was so happy to buy it. And we're going to take it across America, and I'm going to get everyone to introduce it. He got people like, you know, Sean Penn even introduced the film once. So it's in the sense of what it was trying to achieve was more than, I suppose, whatever it was, because the intention was so strong. And it was a comedy as well. And I think, as you were saying, especially up with Anne, when you see the whole Hillsborough 96 thing, when it's done with drama, and especially with what we were doing, when it's done with drama and comedy, it's far more powerful.
OMED's Good Times Tour starts again on the 14th of January. So go and get your jabs and get out there. And we're going to talk about Anne in a minute.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
The four-part ITV drama Anne is one of the most devastating things I've ever watched on a screen of any size. Maxine Peake plays Anne Williams, whose son Kevin died at the Hillsborough disaster in Sheffield in April of 1989. He was 15 years old. The series traces Anne's 24-year journey to get new inquests and some form of justice for Kevin and the other 94 people, now 96 people, who died there. It also looks at the toll it takes on her life, her marriage and her health. I've never seen anything like it before. So before we talk to Kevin Sampson about it, here's a taster.
It's the semi-final of the FA Cup.
Be good.
Yeah, I will.
Have a great time.
3-0 to the Reds.
Barnsley hat-trick.
It's horrible, isn't it? Saying there might be people dead there.
Our Kev's there.
If this was an accident, then it was man-made and it was avoidable.
We need to find those witnesses and prove that Kevin could have been saved.
I was still alive.
I picked him up in my arms and that's when he opened his eyes.
Your Kevin was alive when we left him.
Steve, will you go on TV and say that?
Yeah, and I'll tell him everything.
This was not a case in which it would be right to order fresh inquests.
There's no point in trying to fight these people, because you can't beat them.
My son and 95 Liverpool fans did not die in an accident. They were unlawfully killed.
Kevin, did you know Anne Williams yourself?
I spoke to Anne on many occasions. I wasn't part of her in a circle of campaigners, if you like. But I think in a way that was good, you know, from the in terms of the writing process, having that little bit of distance, you know. Because one thing that I was really kind of conscious not to do was to make it like a hagiography. What you need to do is to, you know, to show off a flawed human being, you know, who's driven to extraordinary lengths to establish the truth of what has happened to her son. But it is at huge cost, you know, to her own health, to her mental health, but to her family, I think significantly, you know, to her family, you have to have a, you know, a well of sympathy for her daughter, Sarah, you know, who was 9 years old on the day that her big brother died. But also to the older brother, Michael, you know, you really, you feel his silent grief throughout. It was important to me to, you know, to depict that, you know, the cost, you know, the human cost. And above all, you know, have to make special mention of Stephen Walters, who portrays Anne's husband, Steve. And that is a masterpiece in silent grief. It's the small moments, these tender moments where he has to start acknowledging that his marriage and his normality is slipping away from him. And he gradually retreats to his garden shed, which becomes a potent symbol of his growing isolation.
Maxine Peake's performance is transfixing. When did she become attached to the film, and what were the conversations you had with her?
The timeline takes us all the way back to Truth Day in 2012, when the Hillsborough Independent Panel revealed its findings and made inevitable the ordering of new inquests, which was what Anne's personal mission was to have new inquests so that she could get the correct cause of death put on Kevin's death certificate. Round about that time, I saw Maxine playing Hamlet on stage. I was just blown away by it. I just thought she was, you know, she was so powerful. When I started having conversations with Simon Heath, who's the executive producer at Will Productions, who made the drama, we were both of the same opinion. It was a short list of one. We just thought that this was something that Maxine was born to play. So there wasn't a huge amount of advocacy or persuasion involved. We approached her agent, who called her, and she immediately said, yeah, the agent was actually saying to her, you know, do you want to read the script first? And she just said, no, I want to do this. I'm in. And I think that's combination of, you know, who she is as a person, you know, her background, the fact that she is politically active and has been a campaigner herself across a number of causes, you know, at home in Bolton and across Greater Manchester. It seemed to us like the right choice, the obvious choice, and she was on board from day one.
I thought I knew the story quite well, but the drama format both makes it new because it renews the emotional impact of it, but also the details that you'd kind of buried or forgotten, or that perhaps the kind of enormity of the things that were done to the survivors and the survivors' families, it kind of makes it new. As you're writing and researching this, did you discover or rediscover things that surprised you about the story? I mean, one of the things that stood out, quite a lot of people have been shocked to discover or rediscover that the original inquest ruled out any evidence after 3:15 p.m. on the day as inadmissible, which presented anew just stuns you.
In putting down that 3:15 limit, then it's ruled out, you know, any evidence being heard or looked at in terms of the response to the disaster, both in terms of the policing on the day and the emergency response. There were so many things that shocked you to the core, you know, the more that you were reading, like you say, some of which I knew and perhaps, you know, had buried, but the automatic and systematic taking of blood alcohol readings on all of the deceased, you know, including children in many cases, was appalling. I think, you know, the sheer tragedy of how many actually could have been saved if the appropriate procedures had been carried out on the day, on the spot. One of the most painful scenes that we see in the drama is where Anne, who is obsessed by now, you know, she is so driven that she has become so immersed that she's obsessed. And this is where, you know, the family is really starting to pay the price of that obsession. But she comes home and she's on a high, having had a consultation with an ear, nose and throat expert at a hospital in Liverpool, who has talked her through what the procedure is, the difference between various types of asphyxia and how you would treat it. And he basically, in crude terms, he says, you know, if somebody with medical expertise, you're talking Boy Scout level first aid, had a biro, the plastic of a biro, and made a small perforation just underneath the Adam's apple, that clears the passages and would have allowed oxygen to flow to the brain. And Kevin and 40 others would have survived, you know, if that basic treatment had been available on the day. And it wasn't. So many things, you know, so many things that you learned during the process. But also, you know, the details of, you know, the personal details and those tender moments that you can only get really by sitting with your subjects. Family, you know, things just as simple as family nicknames. For me, the most symbolically poignant thing was the chain. You know, Anne had given Kevin a neck chain the previous Christmas, which he always wore. And for me, that sort of came to symbolise that umbilical thread, you know, between mother and son, which was destroyed on the day. But she kept his chain, and that helped her to keep her faith.
Listeners might know, some might know, that you were part of the End fanzine in Liverpool in the 80s, which sort of captured the whole kind of Scally football culture. And one of the reasons that I found it sort of like so emotionally tugging on me is that in part because I recognised that world. I recognised the haircuts and the jumpers and the faces and things like that. Were you in a, as a little maybe side project, trying to memorialise that 80s culture of football and show that it was actually about sort of joy and friendship and youth and not just about horror and violence, perhaps?
Yeah, very, very much so. What's important to remember, you know, given that the FA Cup kicks off tonight, is that in that era, you know, in the 70s and 80s, that was the biggest football competition in the world. It had a global audience. Everybody loved the FA Cup. And to be part of it, you know, you wanted to go on, every team wanted to go on the longest cup run that they possibly could. And to get to the semi-final, you know, it was a massive day out. I went myself and it was, you know, it was a beautiful sunny day. And you set off and it's that whole thing of having a laugh. You know, you're full of the joys of spring. You've got the game as your focus, but it's about camaraderie. And going back to some of the details, you know, you see there was some, you know, there was far too many denim shirts and the jeans and trousers had a little bit too much volume to them. But I remember sitting with the director, Bruce Goodison, and saying, look, it's really important, you know, that these details are right. You know, Kevin was wearing Reebok Classics. It would have been a big deal for him, like, you know,
saving
paper round to get those white Reebok Classics. That was what everybody was wearing at the time. And you know, we have to honour that.
Well, I think it's absolutely incredible. The only thing wrong with it is that Merseyrail train in the 80s is way too clean. It would never have been like that. In every other respect, it is 1,000% bang on. Anne is on ITV Hub right now, and you really have to watch it.
As regular listeners know, we ask our guests to bring in a current favourite tune. And as even more regular listeners know, we can't always clear them because the music business is living in the 17th century. Thank you very much. But we always add them to the giant, ongoing, rolling Culture Bunker playlist, which is on Spotify. There is a link at the top of the show notes. Omid Jalili, what have you brought in to add to our ever-expanding stockpile of musical amazingness?
I've recently rediscovered a singer from Brazil called Clara Nunes, who I discovered during the 1982 World Cup because there was some Brazilian Baha'is were staying with us and we were watching the Brazil-Russia game, which was one of the first games of the 82 World Cup in Spain. They picked up on something that the Brazilian fans were singing and they started singing this song. I said, what's that song? And they were saying, it's Dia Dia by Clara Nunes. Oh, she's beautiful. She's a wonderful singer. And I remember the tune and I thought it was wonderful. And then, you know, then they never taught me. I didn't speak Portuguese. I just liked the tune. And then about a year later, I remember watching a Brazil game. Oh, and also we were watching the Brazil-Italy game and Brazil lost 3-2. And it was kind of the death of Brazil, that style of Brazilian football. And they started singing this song again as a kind of mournful thing. And it was when the Brazil team was cool. Brazil as a country was cool. And then I thought I'd look up the song. I came across an album and I went, oh, Clara Nunes. And we had some Brazilian neighbors who said, do you know she just died? And I went, no. And it was a very tragic story. She was 40 years old and she was very loved. It was their Diana, basically. I wouldn't say exactly the same, but it was, she died. She got ill. I think she had cancer and she died pretty quickly. And the whole country was in mourning.
Okay.
And I was always moved by her voice. It's such a clear voice. And there's a bit where in the song where everyone sings, it's a chorus, la Molly now, la 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 la. It's very beautiful. And it always reminds me of the time of the 82 World Cup. But I became obsessed with her when I was younger. And if there was internet in the 80s, I would have Googled her. But I got very little information on her. But now I've seen pictures of her, and every April when it's her you know, when it's the anniversary of her death, I always remember it on Twitter and I get lots of traffic.
Oh, so you're a proper fan. You're a proper fan. We'll put it on the playlist, Clara Nunes.
Beautiful.
Kevin Sampson, what have you chosen today and why?
So I have brought in, I'm a fan of a composer called Ilan Eshkiri. And Ilan is what I think Americans like to call a polymath. And he's scored everything from movies, ballet, rumba, television, movies like Stardust, you know, fittingly, because we're going to go on to talk about David Bowie.
We certainly.
Video games. But I was actually, I became aware of him watching the David Attenborough documentaries. So, you know, there was that beautiful score that accompanies, you know, the Attenborough nature documentaries. A lot of those are scored by him. But just before Christmas, he and Katie Tunstall snuck out an album called the Chasing Wonders LP.
Yes.
And just as a tribute to Anne and Kevin this week, there's a lovely track. So the album is, you know, it's no more than about 25 minutes long. It's almost sketches, you know, with Katie Tunstall's voice as an instrument. But there's a track called Little Hearts, Big Skies, which I think is beautiful and poignant and just fitting for me this week.
Wonderful. We've put it on the playlist. Listeners, you can hear it after you finish the podcast, of course, on our playlist. Right. Toy is the sort of long-lost Bowie album, which is released this weekend as a three-disc set featuring the album, which had a slated 2001 release but was never actually out. Plus, there's two discs with extras and alternative versions. Fellow Bowie geeks will know that Toy was included on the Brilliant Adventure set, which was out last November, but not with the extras. It's in part a covers album, so it's double impossible to clear, but we'll add I Dig Everything to our playlist, as you are now very well aware. This is the most meta release of 2022, probably, in my view. The year has only just begun, even. It's an unreleased album of reworkings recorded around the millennium and now officially released 5 years after his death. Time has gone sideways. Kevin, I'm going to start with you. I have a feeling you're a bit of a Bowie nut. What did you think of Toy?
I love Toy. Like many people of my generation, Bowie, bounced into our front room in the summer of 1969, and I was mesmerized by him. I mean, I can remember it was just before we broke up for the school summer holidays, and everyone was talking about him in the playground. I remember my older brother and, you know, people who were a few years older than me talking about that as almost a sexual experience. For me, it was just like an alien had come down the chimney, and I was fascinated by him and immediately wanted to hear more. You know, that was obviously the famous, you know, the Space Oddity performance.
Yeah.
All I could find was a Decca collection called the World of David Bowie. And I've got to say, I was a little bit disappointed. It didn't sound like this spaceman stuff that we've been hearing. And it had tracks like the London Boys and the Karma Man, Let Me Sleep Beside You, things like that. And they were, you know, they were kind of folky and whimsical, I thought, you know, at that time. Hearing them re-recorded now, it's strange, you know, because they were re-recorded in 2000, 2001. I think they sound now how they should have sounded then. They sound like, you know, it's like West Coast psychedelia. You know, some of it sounds like it could have been on Sgt. Pepper. It could have been recorded by the Byrds. You know, I just really, really, really like it. And I urge anyone who has got a bit of a yen for David Bowie to get stuck in.
Andrew, to me, this features many of his regular musicians, so you know the sound of that time. It's musicians that have been on those late 90s and then noughts albums. Is he redressing the balance here? It feels like he's trying to validate this period from beyond the grave in a way. And this period, I do mean 2000 rather than the
60s. I don't know about trying to validate it. I think it's a really poignant record because songs about youth and escape and excitement and digging everything, when revisited from what we now know is a bit closer to the end of Bowie's life. Well, he wasn't actually that old at the time. He was 20 years before he died. They assume a special quality. The London Boys, of course, was always a song about the emptiness of the groovy London scene. You think you're going to get to London and your life is going to transform. And it does, but not in the way that you expect. And there is a real pathos to it. You know, Bowie famously, of course, played characters throughout his life. And there must be an element at which you ask yourself, am I a real person? Mm. Am I real? Or have I made myself into something plastic that both I and my audience play with? So I think it's really fascinating in that dimension. Also, though, they are great recordings of great songs. And I Dig Everything is hilariously, 1960s, the full wild optimism of the time. Can't Help Thinking About Me. Well, there's a full Warholian stack of self-meta going on there.
yeah.
Which is, of course, the best kind of meta, self-meta. And it's a really good 2000s Bowie album when he had that meaty band together again. And it's the time when he did Glastonbury and it was re-emerging from the less appreciated 1990s, shall we say. So I think it's great. And I think you've got to be of a certain persuasion to want three additional CDs of alternate recordings. That's fine.
But they do have some gems on there. I'm usually fairly cynical about the alternative recordings, but they do have Lisa Jane is on there. There's a Tibet version of Silly Boy Blue, which I think is probably better than the toy version, the album. Omid, are you a Bowie nut? Did you manage to hear any of this?
I loved it, and I can't really add anything more other than my generation of people in their 50s. You kind of measure, your kudos is measured by how much you love Bowie. And all I can say is if you ever go on BBC iPlayer, just tap in Dream Dinner Party, where I've spliced in old interviews of David Bowie with Kenneth Williams, Mo Mollem, Eartha Kitt, and Muhammad Ali, and we have a dinner party together, and it finishes with me singing Starman to David Bowie and him laughing his head off. So that if you're interested in that kind of thing, just go on BBC iPlayer and listen to that.
It sounds like you've tapped into my dream world.
Yes.
I feel like dream about. And you obviously are in that dinner party too.
Kenneth Williams and the Dame, though. I'd like to be there. I'd happily clear the plates.
Kenneth Williams and Muhammad Ali together is a joy to behold.
And Momo. I love that. That's absolutely brilliant. I mean, in some stages, this is him reinventing that Anthony Newley period. There's a lot of that time, whereas Andrew's saying there's the mod period. We know there's a thread to mod, and he's almost casting aside, I don't want that version of me. I want these versions, and I need to rework this, you know, in order for me to move on and to have that thread. And so odd hearing Black Star in some of the songs, the album sounds, all that sort of thing is this, you get this decades long career, I think, and just hearing it. And some of that was just fairly mind blowing to me. And this is the past and the future and the present all at the same time. I'm not really sure which one it is, but I was quite happy with that.
That's because Bowie is a time machine.
Just lastly, what does anyone think about the cover?
Well, the cover, for listeners who don't know, is basically it's a strange baby with the face of aged Bowie on it.
Really with a puzzled bad face over the top.
And a really bad. But then that late period Bowie art was pretty weird, wasn't it? I mean, that strange puppet with the face of Bowie that was prancing around in the Where Are We Now video. It's there to unsettle you.
Finally, do you come from a land down under? Women glow and men can't remember a bloody thing about the mysterious past. It's The Tourist, BBC One's new six-part thriller, which stars Jamie Dornan from 50 Shades of Grey and The Fall, not the band. It also stars Line of Duty's Shalom Brune Franklin as Lucy and Dumplin' star Danielle McDonald as a rookie cop called Helen Chambers. Jamie Dornan's character, who has no name at first, finds himself in hospital in a small town in Australia. He can't remember anything. What on earth has happened? Let's listen to the trailer.
Why would somebody want me dead?
You're looking for an Irishman.
Are you sure you want to know who you really are?
It's 9 when the clock says 10. Let's go.
You're awake. So, can you tell me your name?
You've got, like, amnesia?
Yeah.
That is awesome!
Kevin Sampson, I'm going to start with you. The first scene, we see Jamie being chased by a huge mega truck in the Australian outback. He doesn't seem surprised. He crashes, then he gets amnesia. What did you make of the setup, now being a TV person yourself?
I absolutely loved it. I love things like this. I think what they do is they give the audience what they want rather than what might plausibly have happened. And in that first couple of minutes, there's something of a homage to Jeepers Creepers, right down to the slightly haunting use of a guy in snakeskin boots whistling this kind of childish refrain. Of course, you know, Jamie Dornan's character, the man with no name, sees this mega truck bearing down on him with its horn blaring. Conveniently, they're the only two cars on the road.
It's the outback. So, nothing happens.
So Jamie pulls off the road and seems to cunningly throw him off the trail while simultaneously being word perfect on Kim Carnes' Betty Davis eyes.
You're right.
Gets back onto a road, punches the air with absolute joy because he seems to have thrown the manic trucker off. And, of course, you just know that he is going to be any second now blindsided with one almighty crash, and it doesn't disappoint. And from that point on, he wakes up in hospital and sort of memento style tries to piece together who he is and why somebody wants to kill him. Like I say, it's not something that you're following because you think that this is any way, the storytelling at times is just joyously absurd, but it's so kind of hooky. And the Williams brothers, you know, who are the guys that created Missing and Liar and Relic and things, you know, this is what they do. They're absolute masters at it. And I have not got to the final episode yet, so no spoilers, please. But all I can tell you is that by the end of that first episode, I was gagging for more.
That's wonderful. I could not have said that better myself. Andrew, this is also an ensemble piece. It's not just hunking Jamie Dornan on the screen. There's Danielle McDonald, who plays this eccentric junior cop, whatever they're called in real life. What did you make of her and the other characters that surround the mystery man?
I was not as bowled over as Kevin because I thought this was perhaps being swamped by its own quirks. I think that character in particular, the Helen Chambers, the trainee cop, maintains a sort of twitchy, I'm just a kooky kind of individual, inverted commas around her personality and behaviour, through incidents that would reduce a real human being to a gibbering wreck. Genuine horrors and shocks and violence and trauma. The producers here, obviously the Fleabag people, I found that stretch between what we were asked to buy as the drama and the way we were also asked to buy contemporary kookiness just too far.
You're not having the cheese pockets scene as a metaphor for the futility of life.
I'm not, actually. I'm not. And I have got to say, I found the subplot of Fallon Chambers and her Sebastian Gorka lookalike fiancé fantastically irritating.
Ooh.
His world of, he's a controlling, the fiancé is a controlling figure who is basically dragooning Helen through an Australian version of Fat
Fighters.
This is
going to be a pivot for the plot, Andrew. This is going to propel more action later. You must do. It has to.
I'm sort of three quarters of the way through it now, and it's propelled one or two things. But what this thing is completely lacking in is any economy of thought and action. Scenes are immensely baggy. Like I say, we're given a surfeit of quirk rather than either the propulsive nature that you require from a thriller, or if we're going to be watching a quirky personality drama, does it necessarily need to be riven with conspiracy and clues and so forth? That said,
ooh,
I think
you didn't like your genre hopping, did you?
I don't think it does. I think it doesn't mix them well.
Right.
That said, a few of the little kind of turning points, a few of the little teeny tiny clues on which major plot moments center are very clever. Mm. There's one that involves the Spice Girls, shall we say. So some of those things I quite liked. But I have to say I found my patience with it wearing a little bit thin. And I was a bit like, would you get to the bloody point here? It felt like an hour drama that had been put on the medieval stretching rack and quirked up beyond certainly the tolerance of a carbuncular old sod like me.
Goodness me. Omid, I'm desperate to get to you. Does this provide even much needed escapism for January?
I was very happy to wait to see what you guys thought, because if you hated it, I would have said I loved it.
Yeah.
But now it seems that Kevin and Sean, you love it. I'm going to say I absolutely hated it.
I knew you were the right guy for the podcast.
I hated it. I had lots of reasons which I could easily say why I loved it, but I think Kevin said that very beautifully. The reasons why I didn't like it is because, again, it's about tone. If you look at Don't Look Up, where it got, for me, it got the tone right.
Yeah.
Here, there is supposed to be comedy in it. There is supposed to be suspense. Of course, it's a very interesting twist on an idea. Here's a character, and then we discover who he is. It's kind of in the opposite way. But I found I couldn't get into the comedy of it. I couldn't get into the tongue-in-cheek irony of it. I thought it was a little bit muddled, and I did the. I know things like Ozark, Breaking Bad, they do stretch things, but then you're really into the drama of it so much that it doesn't matter. Mm. You can hold, you don't want to take your eyes off the screen, because if you take your eyes off, you've missed an eye movement that is extremely important. And here, I didn't think it was important. I watched two episodes, and I'm with Andrew in the sense that I found myself fast-forwarding quickly to get on with the story, because also Jamie Dornan is he's an interesting person. I liked him. I love the fact there's someone who's Northern Irish, and it seemed fresh and original. But if you don't buy into if you're not into the hero, because we don't know him, you can't really root for him either way. I found the whole thing, I was ambivalent to the whole thing. I didn't really care.
That's interesting, because I was going to ask Kevin as a screenwriter, but I can ask everybody, obviously, that is this Helen Chambers' story? I actually thought that maybe we're going through her eyes, whereas I thought it was going to be Jamie Dornan's at the start, because we know as little as he does, but then does he know more? I think because she is the character that knows the least, it's through her, and then I could identify with that, and then that was my in.
I agree.
Maybe, but I don't think it really, it doesn't follow the action through her, though. She's not our proxy. She pops up for various plot purposes and also to further, I don't think, a particularly captivating domestic story. You don't join scenes with her. You don't follow, when a character is a proxy character, you expect them to be on screen most of the time, and you expect to discover things at their pace. And that's just simply not how this is structured. My big problem with it was I just felt like it was several chunks of different dramas jammed together, much as a little kid will take three different Lego kits and make you something that's part spaceship, part Pirates of the Caribbean boat, part microwave oven.
No, can I just say, I think what Andrew has said is very indicative of new writers and new directors who have been brought up watching so much. And it's a bit like how Quentin Tarantino, he's a student, so he's chucked lots. If you're a student of film, you know he's taken this from that, he's taken that from that. But somehow he's put together something that is interesting and original enough for you to say, okay, that's Quentin Tarantino-esque. Here, it does feel like it's a bunch of people who've studied film.
There's a very Coen Brothers sort of.
Yeah, it's very conscious.
Adjacent.
It's very self-conscious. Yeah. I do like Danielle McDonald. I do like the police character.
Yeah, I really like
her. She's interesting.
And I have a real soft spot for bungling police, whether they be the Agent Rogers character, who is deeply eccentric and rings his wife every morning at 10 o'clock in the morning, come what may, or it's her who's really trying to navigate how she's going to be a quote unquote proper policewoman. That's something that I absolutely adore. So I'm just in there straight.
Me too, Sean. Like me too. Right.
Well, there we go.
Never underestimate the allure of the bungling cop who comes good in the end.
That was in my notes, in my Boris Johnson-esque having a Brexiteer and Remain letter ready to go if I become Prime Minister. I do believe that character, the bumbling character, and actually I disagree with Andrew. I like the fact that I thought it was brilliant. He's a Sebastian Gorka-esque husband. I thought that was genius. That's very funny. And I love that there is that's when I stop fast forwarding. What are these two doing? What is their subplot? And the fact he says things like, oh, you can be pretty again. There are little lines like that. You think, okay, there's something interesting going on.
I thought that
was original.
If they'd committed to that story, binned off the mystery in the desert, you would have had a superior version of the Young Doctors or possibly Neighbours.
As well. You know, alongside things. I mean, Anne is amazing. And I would say, you know, again, I just want to repeat how devastating it is, but how fantastic. But then I also needed this in the same token. I just thought it was fantastic escapism.
To decompress. Well, finally, our rolling playlist also includes the greatest songs of all time, as chosen by our guests. Omid, what's your greatest song of all time and why?
America, A Horse with No Name, only because I found out that was Osama bin Laden's favorite song.
Was it really?
Along with supporting Arsenal. These are little details that are coming out, which is why I included it in my television show. Well, I played a gay Scottish film director who directs his bin Laden's video addresses, and he combines A Horse with No Name as a new a video he's going to give to the world, a music video where he sings Horse with No Name, combined with a yet to be released video he's made called Trick Shots with bin Laden, which is his snooker DVD, where bin Laden's doing snooker trick shots. And so we have a video that's made with bin Laden doing a trick shot while he's singing A Horse with No Name. It's the most original music video out there. So it's on my Instagram page. Go and look for it.
I'll be going, as soon as we finish recording, I'll be going to have a look at that. Kevin Sampson, what are you choosing as the greatest record of all time to put into the Bunker Time Machine?
It's Bowie week this week. Yay. So my song of all time this week is Bowie's version of Wild is the Wind from Station to Station. It was written, or music was written, by Dmitri Chomkin, and given that Christmas is still a recent memory, he also wrote It's a Wonderful Life, amongst many other, you know, wonderful, wonderful film themes. So Wild is the Wind by David Bowie.
And we'll drop them straight into the playlist for you.
As America and Bowie go on the Bunker Cinematic Universe playlist, we're at the end of the podcast, and it's closing time chatter. What will we be discussing as we uncover another cadaver in the outback and reveal our true identities for perhaps the fourth or fifth time? Kevin?
It could have been the sale of Bowie's catalogue for something like 175 million smackaroonies. It could have been the announcement of two new Rebus books by the great Ian Rankin. But I can only talk about the sensation that is the new series of Cobra Kai. I just love it. It's got everything. In short, you know, Cobra Kai is the reboot of The Krassy Kid, as we all know, and it plays variations on a theme of bullies will end up becoming bullies in adult life unless we do something to stop them. And in this latest manifestation of Cobra Kai, it's the return of the sinister Terry Silver, who joins forces.
He's on Brookside, wasn't he?
Oh, it's wonderful. So there's a host of new characters. All our hardy perennials are still there, albeit play into that wonderful trope of, you know, ones who were old in the first place are suddenly looking like middle-aged men playing teenagers. The guy that plays Miguel is certainly starting to look as though he needs to go on a road trip, and indeed does by the end of it. But with a soundtrack of the worst in American kind of soft metal, it is not to be missed. Cobra Kai.
Wonderful. Brilliant. Andrew, what's
I loved
yours?
It as well. I loved it. It's a very good, great choice.
Okay. I'm going to check it out. Andrew, what's yours?
It's the greatest week of the year because out of nowhere comes the announcement that there's a new Half Man, Half Biscuit album coming out. This will speak to both Kevin and to Omid, as he has a Wirral connection. The album is called The Voltarol Years. I had to look up what Voltarol is. I think I'm going to be needing it pretty soon. And it's, as we know, their song titles alone are an entertainment. Mm. There's one on the new one called Tess of the Dormobiles and another one called I'm Getting Buried in the Morning. But my favourite little aspect of it is that they're no longer on Pro Plus Records because Jeff from Pro Plus has retired, a well-earned retirement. Mm-hmm. So they've set up their own label and it's called RM Qualtroff Records. And what the hell is that? I Googled it. It is a mystery name connected to an unsolved domestic murder in Wolverton Street, Anfield in 1931. Mm-hmm. So don't say you don't get deep content from Half Man, Half Biscuit. Mm-hmm. This is coming out in February and you can rest assured we'll be talking about it on this programme, whether you like it or not, Sean.
I know what your review is already. Omid, what's your closing time chatter?
My closing time chatter is that my social media feeds have been absolutely chock-a-full of this young lady. Can we use the word farts on this?
We feed? Certainly
you can. It's uncensored.
Yeah.
Okay, it's uncensored. Okay, well, she's been selling jars of her farts for $1,000 a jar.
Yes, absolutely.
And apparently she's got ill and she's gone to hospital because the food that she's been eating to make her fart has made her ill. And it's interesting, I had the same idea a few years ago. And unfortunately, it was the only business that I had that I followed through. And apparently, apparently jars of my own shit are not as popular.
Oh, no. If I could say farts in a bottle.
So that's the story. That's all over my timeline, all of yesterday and today.
Yeah, goodness me.
Beautiful stuff.
Thank you.
Greatest B-side of all time, Life's a Gas.
Sean, what's yours?
I'm continuing this Liverpool theme, I feel. Grange Hill, the movie.
Hooray! Brilliant.
Phil Redman has finished the script, apparently. It's due in late 2022, which seems a bit fast. But maybe it will be done. I mean, just look it up. I can't say any more than how excited I am about this. The original characters will apparently be playing the grandparents of the young characters at school, which is...
This is it's Cobra Kai. This is it, Kev. This is it. Cobra Kai, they realise, Netflix and all these people realise... Cobra Kai was on YouTube only, and then Netflix bought it because they realized people in their 50s who watched the film in 84 were going bananas. So Phil Redman understands that this is our generation. It's the people in their 50s who remember Grange Hill. That is the big, that's the he knows. We're the big people who watch everything.
He's not a silly man. He also, there's a great feature in The Guardian, if you do want to look it up, where he talks about what Channel 4 is for now and why does it exist. And I do remember, and I feel a soft spot for what Channel 4 started as and what it wanted to be and what it is now. He's very clever. He should be king of all TV. I mean, he almost is, but I'm so excited about this. January just keeps on giving, doesn't it?
I'm just imagining a gigantic sausage with a fork in it flying over Britain.
Oh, that would be wonderful, wouldn't it?
Like on the cover of the Pink Floyd album.
Yeah, absolutely.
Make it happen. Crowdfund it.
Let's do it. Oh, that's the end of the podcast on that sausagey note. Thank you so much to Omid Jalili and Kevin Sampson for being with us and joining us for our first Culture Bunker of the year. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Enjoy your weekend.
We've had a wonderful time. Thank you. Take care.
Wonderful. It's been wonderful.
It's been great having you on.
From me, Andrew, producers Alex Rees and Yelena Sofronijevic, thank you for listening and we'll see you next week.
The Culture Bunker was produced and presented by Andrew Harrison with Sean Pattenden. The assistant producer was Yelena Sofronijevic and audio production was by me, Alex Rees. Theme tune by Kenny Dickinson. The Culture Bunker is a Podmasters production.